compensation committees can fall into the challenge of becoming too much like management, where they're wanting to own succession planning. They want to own the incentive design. They want to own how things are approved. And we have the possibility of jumping into either one of those roles.
Welcome to the Executive Compensation Podcast. On this show, we discuss all aspects of executive compensation. Whether you're a compensation committee member, a seasoned compensation professional, or just curious to learn more about executive compensation, this show is the answer. Each episode brings you a focused and actionable interview on specific topics of executive compensation. This episode is brought to you by Meridian Compensation Partners. Meridian works with compensation committees to ensure the most effective processes are in place to go beyond mere compliance with governance requirements and create healthy, dynamic relationships between the board, management, and its advisors. Meridian helps boards use compensation to attract and retain critical talent and to make informed business decisions that will link pay and performance, drive business results, increase shareholder value, and mitigate potential risks. Learn more at meridiancp.com.
Welcome to the Executive Compensation Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Harvey, and on this episode, I'm joined by Jared Berman. Jared is a partner out of Meridian's Detroit office. And Jared, welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you, Ryan. It's great to join you.
So today we're going to be exploring the topic of executive compensation governance. Oversight and governance of compensation is critical to the success of a company, but it can be fraught with difficulty. A company's management team should have involvement in the development and design of compensation incentive structures. However, there are inherent conflicts of interest if management is designing pay and setting incentive goals without the proper insight. So today we're going to explore the nuances of governance. What are the appropriate roles of the compensation committee and the management team in the process? And what role should the compensation committee's advisors be playing? So Jared, you know, before we get into the kind of the depth of some of those roles and how the governance process can play out, I wanted to just set the stage a little bit around what are some of the basic ground rules, some of the basic structures that we generally see setting the stage for how governance plays out within a compensation committee. Can you kind of just paint the picture of what that structure typically looks like?
Yeah, Ryan, thank you for that. And where I would start is, you know, as you and our listeners know, every compensation committee meets 4 to 5 times a year, depending on their annual cadence and cycle, with the largest meetings tending to be in Q4 and Q1, right? As we really get into the end of the year, we're seeing how companies are shaking out on their incentive plans for the current year, and then starting to talk about what are they planning on doing for the future in Q1, and then making ultimately all the approvals. And then things are a little slower in Q2 and Q3, where it's really more about say on pay, proxy advisor reports on them, or the shareholder meeting results. But kind of within that framework, Ryan, is really the actual committee calendar and working between the advisors, management, and the committee chair to really outline and lay out exactly what topics will be covered at which meeting throughout the cycle, with a real focus on what, you know, is usually referred to as 2 bites of the apple, right? Making sure that we are planful in bringing forth any new ideas, new solutions, or new recommendations ahead of time so that there's ample time for the committee to weigh in with their thoughts, to give feedback, and then to ultimately curate that to become what eventually goes for approval at the right meeting. But I would even take a step back from that, Ryan, and say that really one of the most important things is the committee charter, right? Every compensation committee, every audit and nominating governance committee has it. And as I have more experience in this environment, I realize how important that charter really is, right? There's a lot of standard stuff that has to comply with New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, the SEC, but ultimately, being very definitive about who is covered in a charter and what topics are covered in a charter ultimately comes down to what goes in that meeting calendar. And, you know, when push comes to shove and there are any sort of question marks about who owns this topic, we default back to that charter very regularly. And if we don't get that right from the outset, we can sometimes run into questions about who actually owns a decision. Specifically, as you know, business unit presidents are probably a great example where sometimes they're part of the C-suite, sometimes they're part of the NEO group or the executive officer group, and sometimes they're not. And who really owns that topic?
No, I agree. And getting that fundamental question answered before you get into the midst of a decision is helpful, because once you're in the midst of a specific question and then you're debating, is this the purview of the committee? Is it the purview of the management? It's kind of too late at that point. But when you can do that up front at the beginning of the calendar and really agree within that charter, like you said, is to who's covering what topics and what's the purview, I think that's the right time to do it.
Yeah. And, you know, Ryan, sometimes it does make sense to take a step back, both as a committee and us as advisors, to say, well, what do we want to cover in this committee? Is this a board-owned item? Is this a nominating governance-owned item? Is this something that really should even be in our charter? I think we have a tendency to review it from a compliance standpoint, but maybe less so from a philosophical standpoint of what does the committee actually want to handle and tackle, and to what level do we draw those lines of delineation between what we should be covering or what really is a management decision that doesn't need our, not even our, but the committee's opinion or insight or approval.
Because you can definitely go too far on either end of the spectrum of either too much oversight of things that really just make you an ineffective committee, or too little and now you're not really governing like you should be. Why don't we dive in a little bit here? Maybe we'll kind of break the different, you know, kind of constituencies up into different groups and start with management. I'd love to hear from you. You know, what are your perspectives on how should management be involved? Obviously, management's in a unique position because on one hand, they're the ones that are closest to the business and information. At the same time, there can potentially be inherent conflicts of interest when you're dealing with things that impact their pay. So where should they be involved? What's the right balance there on the management side?
Yeah, Ryan, I agree. This is one of the more tricky parts of the world that we live in, right? You know, we always use this mantra, you know, incentive plans should be developed and owned by management, right? And the committee ultimately should be, their job should be to ask questions to make sure that it's aligned, that the management proposals are aligned with shareholder interests. And it's really more of a governance role. But at the end of the day, I think that those lines blur pretty drastically, right? As you know, when we advise our clients, one of the first things we say is, tell us more about your company. Tell us more about your vision. Tell us more about your short and long-term business strategy. And then we try to use market reference points or best practices as kind of a barometer for what our clients are currently doing or maybe what they should be thinking about doing. But at the end of the day, you know, compensation committees and boards more generally have a view as to what ultimately will lead the business forward and ultimately create value. And, you know, management will want to come forth with metrics that they believe in, things that the CEO or the operating team is trying to drive towards. But as you note, there is this conflict of interest between not so much the selection of the metrics, but sometimes the goals that are being set and how that will ultimately relate to the outcomes at the end of the year or at the end of a 3-year cycle. So I guess from my perspective, Ryan, you know, I think that management really should own the design, right? They are the ones driving towards a philosophy and a strategy. They are the ones that believe that certain metrics are going to create value. I think it's our job as advisors to help them think through what others are doing or what we've learned as lessons in terms of design constructs. But I do think that ultimately should be a management proposal that the board can either support or not support. But when it comes to the goal setting part, I think that's where it gets a little bit muddier.
Yeah, goal setting, and we have done podcasts, but we could do a whole podcast just around, you know, how do you set goals? But any thoughts there? I mean, my experience generally is that the management team almost by default has to bring forward the goals. They're the ones that are, you know, running the operations of the business. But how does the committee evaluate that and make sure that it's that there's the appropriate level of stretch, but it's also achievable? Any kind of high level thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I'm sure you've experienced this as well. Different clients do different things, right? Some default to the board and they say it's really just about the budget that's approved at the end of the year or at the end of the day. And if the board approves a budget, that just gets plugged in to the framework that's already been approved. So I have certain committees that really focus more on the metric selection, the length of time period that we're measuring, and they focus a lot on the curve. And what I mean by curve is, where do you set threshold relative to target? Where do you set maximum relative to target? What's the appropriate sharing ratios and the like across the spectrum of the opportunities? But then they leave the budget setting process to the board of directors. And I find that that actually works very nicely because the board has a broader set of context than I think just the compensation committee. And they're really talking about broader scope of business issues and macroeconomic headwinds or tailwinds that really drive the budget. I think where it gets a little bit challenging is that companies have a different philosophy. For instance, we have to grow every year, irrespective of macroeconomic environments, right? That sets the framework for how we're going to be setting goals in a year. I have a client who sets it based off of analyst expectations. That changes the whole paradigm there as well. So I think there are different nuances, but ultimately I think most of my clients default back towards budget equals target. Our job as a compensation committee is to really define the framework not necessarily the specific target goal.
Makes sense. Makes sense. One last question on management, and then we'll shift to another constituency. But from the management perspective, I know there's varying schools of thought as to at what level should the management team just really have purview to set pay levels and design, and where does the committee kind of purview begin? And of course, there's regulatory guidelines as to, you know, areas that the committee has to cover. But in your experience, what is that right level where below that level, the management team should really have general purview over setting compensation design and whatnot without getting necessarily committee input?
Yeah, where I tend to draw my own kind of gray line is CEO and direct reports. I think that's, for lack of anything more descriptive from a SEC requirement or designation, I think that's a nice leveling way for a committee to look at who's really at the top of the house and who should be under their purview. I think it gets a little tricky on the divisional roles. As you know, some companies count divisional roles as executive officers, some do not. I think kind of the largest division presidents typically fall under the purview, even if they're not named as an executive officer of the company. And I do think, Ryan, that there's a little bit of a distinction to be drawn between approvals on annual pay adjustments or annual pay opportunities, and then an overall awareness from a succession planning standpoint of how different people fit in from a outstanding value of equity and a retention hook standpoint, some of those kind of key high potential or high performing individuals. So I don't know that just because one or two executives aren't directly under the charter or aren't directly required in approval, I still think a compensation committee wants to know how those folks are progressing through their career, how they've defined their own business units, and what's the stickiness of that executive. You know, Ryan, going through this Q1 cycle, I don't know if you've had this debate at your clients, but the question about whether executives should be tied to individual or strategic goals as part of the incentive plan has become, to me, a very interesting question mark, right? I would kind of align this with your question about, you know, CEOs, I think sometimes struggle between wanting to tie their executive team to line of sight objectives, things that are strategic in nature or maybe non-financial in nature, but things that are going to move the business forward. What's the committee and management's interplay between wanting to really hold people accountable for individual results, but ultimately wanting to pay for business results and value creation? That one's a fascinating one.
I definitely agree, Jared. And I would say that I've seen even maybe a mini trend. Maybe it's just among my clients, but I've definitely seen a mini trend to increased interest in non-financial and strategic objectives among, you know, the goals for the senior team. In certain cases, I think it's almost critical. I've got clients that are working through very specific strategic transformations where it makes a lot of sense. But even outside of those situations, I would definitely see these a fair amount of interest, increased interest in recent years in that area.
Yeah, I think, Ryan, certainly since COVID, we've seen kind of a growing trend in trying to create an element of the program that goes beyond, you know, net income or EBITDA or cash flow, right? Something that really is priorities that have to be accomplished in a 12-month period to lead towards longer-term results that don't show up in the financial statements in any given period. I think the tricky part, you know, from my perspective is, are those corporate-wide shared strategic priorities that the whole management team takes part in together at the same rating? Is that individual ratings or allocations of performance at the end of the year, is that a modifier or a carved-out piece? And ultimately, how do you differentiate 6 to 8 executives who are all seemingly high performers, or else they wouldn't be in the jobs that they're in? And how do you balance the desire to hold them accountable for functional specific tasks when that may be different than the organizational success or failures? And then ultimately, how do you feel comfortable about reporting out in the proxy disclosure about an executive who maybe had a stellar year versus their peers who maybe were more average, or some executive who maybe missed their goals? And are you willing to take that hardline stance of, we are going to give them a rating below 100 or, you know, even 50 and report out what was missed? And I think that's just a very interesting conversation that has to take place ultimately at most of our clients.
Yeah, no easy right answer. Like so many things we talk about, it's about trade-offs. There's advantages to incorporating those objectives. And as you just mentioned, a lot of things you got to consider that could potentially be downsides. So I want to shift a little bit while we have a few minutes left here to just talk a little bit about the committee and then also maybe a minute or two about advisors, but start with the committee. So when we think about the overall governance process, what are areas, you know, where should the committee really be focused? And I guess also the committee chair, you know, what are some of the things that they should be driving either in combination with the management team, or maybe in some cases there's things that, you know, the committee or the committee chair should be working almost completely independent from management related to governance?
Yeah, Ryan, I think that the compensation committee chair's role is very important. And, you know, I guess the way I would explain it is one of their primary jobs is to create an environment of facilitation, right? Committee chair obviously gives his or her viewpoints along the way. They're part of more conversations, both with the advisors and the management team as the year goes on. But ultimately, when we get to the meeting, one of their primary jobs is to ensure that all of the committee members have an opportunity to A, understand what's being presented to them or being suggested as a recommendation, but then give everybody an opportunity to speak up and to weigh in, but ultimately then bring it back to the topic at hand and make sure that we can get towards a resolution that's very needed for the company to move forward in any of their incentive plans or the approvals. And a lot of committee chairs accomplish this in a variety of ways. Sometimes there's pre-socialization, making sure that there are some pre-calls or pre-emails that happen before the meeting, alerting the committee members to any sensitive topic or any topic that's a little bit more not buttoned up yet or still having more conversation. I have some committee chairs that choose to use a pre-executive session, so they'll maybe limit a 5 to 10 minute executive session at the outset of the meeting, making sure that all the committee members are aligned with what they should be focused on listening to or asking questions about throughout the meeting. And then ultimately, how do they use the closing executive session? Some committee chairs prefer to hold all approvals until executive session so that the committee really has an opportunity to debate amongst themselves and in private. But how that committee chair plays with his or her role in facilitation and ultimately getting support and approvals, I think is critical to seeing a successful committee management and advisor relationship.
Yep. No, definitely agree. I mean, as much as getting to a correct answer, I think as important as getting is the process that you get there. And I think we've all seen examples where you get to maybe a correct answer, but the process is, you know, people feel really burned through the process. And so it's very important, like you said, all of those various steps from the committee chair. And that's where we can support the committee chair in that process too, to make sure that people feel heard, that all of the information has been shared, been vetted, and that when you do get to that right answer, everyone gets there feeling like, you know, like the process was appropriate. So,
yeah, there needs to be enough opportunities for questions, for additional ideas to be vetted, but ultimately approvals have to happen, right? We get to a point where grant dates have to happen, bonuses have to be approved, decisions have to be made. So making sure that, again, going back to that committee calendar, going back to that charter, going back to the right process, like you said, I think is critical to make sure that everybody feels like the conversation was the right conversation. We may not all be happy with the outcomes or the answer, but at least it was handled appropriately.
So I think that dovetails into the last topic I wanted to spend a minute or two on, which is just how do the advisors to the committee help in this process and facilitate the governance process? So what's kind of the ideal role from your perspective of how advisors can help?
Yeah, Ryan, I think our primary objective is making sure that all of the conversations that should be happening are happening. I mean, ultimately, I think as an advisor, we're not looking for any specific outcome, not looking for any specific answer. And it certainly doesn't have to be our idea that ultimately gets approved. That's not how I define success. I define success as the questions that need to be asked and answered are happening, that folks can feel like that everything was vetted properly, pros and cons were evaluated, the pluses and minuses and the trade-offs were considered carefully. When all of that happens, I know as an advisor, I can sleep very well at night, knowing that ultimately whatever decision the committee makes or management makes is a thoughtful decision. And it's one that they all believe is in the best interest of moving the business forward and driving the right behaviors and outcomes. I do think that we as advisors sometimes fall into this thing of we will avoid surprises, right? How many of us have said that or thought about that? But that becomes really tricky because, Ryan, I don't know about you, but every time I sit in a meeting, I learn something new. There's a different conversation. There's a different question that was asked. There was a different spin on some piece of information that was presented at the last meeting or is now being presented, and the world changes. And so I think, you know, I might twist that one, right, a little bit and say, we shouldn't hold back anything that we would want to say to a committee that we know going in, right? We should have that conversation openly and transparently with our management teams, with our compensation committee chairs. We should prepare everybody for our thoughts and views. But I also think that there are times as advisors, Ryan, where we need to speak our mind based on the new pieces of information we hear. We have to do it in a productive and a constructive way. But I do think that, you know, as advisors, that is our job, is say, we heard something different this time. And with that new information, here's how you might think about this, or here's a question we would want to know the answer to. And I think that's probably the best expertise, is to be able to hear those, digest those, and then present that back to the committee to, again, ensure that they're having an open and thoughtful dialogue.
Definitely agree. That whole process, like we said, is so important. And it's a balancing act that we play in our role to number one, make sure that we're laying out all of the trade-offs, because so many of these decisions have so many trade-offs. But it, as you said, also being willing to have a point of view, because we're sitting in all these meetings, we're hearing things, not only from that particular company, but from dozens of other companies. And I think the committee, you know, they need to hear a point of view. But even there's a balance, because if we push too hard with a point of view, we start to cross the line where, are we now acting more as a director, which that's not our role. Our role is the advisor. So there's always that kind of fine balance of having a point of view, but at the same time, making sure we're not influencing the kind of conversation in a way that starts to position us more as if we're one of the directors, which of course we're not.
Yeah, it's a great point, because compensation committees can fall into the challenge of becoming too much like management, where they're wanting to own succession planning. They want to own the incentive design. They want to own how things are approved. And we have the possibility of jumping into either one of those roles, quite frankly, where we think we should be designing the programs for the management team or be the oversight arm for the compensation committee. So I think it is important, Ryan, as you say, we all have a role to play, and kind of setting that out up front. You know, what are the priorities? What are the things that are covered? What is all of our roles in this? I think is a quite helpful thing to make sure that we're all having the right discussion. And then whatever is approved is a thoughtful, well-vetted conclusion.
This has been, I think, a very helpful conversation, Jared. I know, you know, we're recording this at the end of Q1 here, and I know you've been through dozens and dozens of committee meetings over the last few weeks. So a lot of this is very fresh experience, but been very helpful and I think appreciated by our listeners. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity, Ryan.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Executive Compensation Podcast. You can see more about this episode along with additional executive compensation insights at meridiancp.com. That's Meridian, the letter C and the letter P.com. This episode is brought to you by Meridian Compensation Partners. Meridian works with compensation committees to ensure the most effective processes are in place to go beyond mere compliance with governance requirements and create healthy, dynamic relationships between the board, management, and its advisors. Meridian helps boards use compensation to attract and retain critical talent and to make informed business decisions that will link pay and performance, drive business results, increase shareholder value, and mitigate potential risks. Learn more at meridiancp.com.